Hello, I'm Rhea Blakey for Discovery Channel CME. Our topic today is the role of insulin to improve glucose control in type 2 diabetes. We'd like to thank the University of Virginia School of Medicine for accrediting the program. We'd also like to thank Eli Lilly and Company for providing the educational grant to make this program possible. Physicians and other healthcare professionals can earn free CME credit by registering online at discoverychannelcme.com and taking the post test. All the graphics and references from today's program will also be available online. It's easy to log on, take the post test, and earn free credit for the program, so do it today. We're fortunate to have a distinguished group of experts in the studio with us today to talk about the use of insulin in patients with diabetes. Dr. Anthony L. McCall, James M. Moss, Professor of Diabetes, University of Virginia School of Medicine, Charlottesville, Virginia. Dr. Helena Rodbard, past president of the American College of Endocrinology and past president of the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, Rockville, Maryland. And Dr. Frank Lavernia, founder of the North Broward Diabetes Center, Pompano Beach, Florida. Thank you all for joining us today. Now, during the next hour, we plan to discuss the following: recent trends in the epidemiology of type 2 diabetes, with a particular focus on the impact of minorities and the elderly, the pathophysiology of type 2 diabetes, the data supporting the importance of aggressive glycemic control in type 2 diabetes, the kinetics of insulin replacement in patients with type 2 diabetes, current strategies for the use of different types of insulin, including basal, prandial, and concentrated insulin in reaching glycemic targets, and barriers and misconceptions about insulin therapy, as well as strategies to combat them, including improved communication with patients. Now, by now, most people are aware that diabetes, particularly type 2 diabetes, has become an epidemic. Doctors, let's start by reminding your colleagues just how common diabetes is.
Well, diabetes is a very common disease. In this country alone, there are over 24 million people with diabetes, of which about one-third of them don't even know that they have the disease. And as you mentioned, Rhea, this is a disease that affects disproportionately minorities. African Americans, about 15% of the population has diabetes. Hispanic Americans, about 12% of those people are affected with diabetes. And it's also a disease that this affects disproportionately the older population. About one in every four people over the age of 60 has diabetes, and it is growing. This incidence is growing at a rate of about 1.5 million people per year.
It's a huge problem. And we're seeing it every day. We're seeing it increase disproportionately also in younger people. The increase is larger in younger people, working age population, even type 2 diabetes showing up in teenagers and younger age. So the children's onset versus adult onset distinction has been blurred by the epidemic.
What are some of the reasons why we're seeing such an increase in the numbers of cases?
Yeah, the problem in the United States right now is increasing obesity, which parallels with diabetes. They're like conjoined twins. And the second reason we're seeing a lot of new diabetics is that we're getting better at doing diagnostics.
What's the impact of diabetes on society? Dr. Rodbard?
Well, it's a very costly disease. It's a disease that currently costs our society about one-fifth of the healthcare dollars. So it's really very expensive. The latest statistics show that $174 billion is devoted annually for the management of the diabetes in society. The lion's share of that goes to complications and hospitalizations. Physicians' fees account for about 11%. The cost of medications is only about 9%. Complications and hospitalizations are really responsible for most of the dollars and cents that go to the management of diabetes. Not even talking about the impact that has on people's lives, their happiness, their social life, their productivity in the workplace.
Well, before we start our discussion about the role of insulin, it might be a good time to remind your colleagues about the pathophysiology of type 2 diabetes.
Diabetes is a dual defect disease. Most people with type 2 diabetes are going to have a certain degree of insulin resistance, but people don't actually develop diabetes until they develop insulin deficiency. And typically what happens, the first manifestation is an increase in the postprandial blood glucose levels. Those are the blood glucose levels that ensue following a meal. And eventually the fasting plasma glucose level will also increase. And in fact, it's estimated that by the time someone is diagnosed with diabetes, they have lost about 50% of the pancreatic beta cell insulin secretion.
The key aspects of type 2 diabetes are insulin resistance, an inadequate ability of the body to respond by glucose lowering to its own insulin. And the second aspect, which is important as well, is lack of adequate insulin reserves so that the body doesn't make enough to compensate for the insulin resistance. Those are the two key features, and that's key to the need for insulin.
I know there's been some controversy in the last 2 years or so regarding the aggressive control of type 2 diabetes. Now, what's the latest thinking on that?
Well, there have been a number of epidemiologic trials, some of them going back into the 1980s, and there hasn't been any question at all that aggressive management of diabetes helps to decrease the microvascular complications. Those are the diseases related to the eyes, to the kidneys, to the neuropathy. But there has been some controversy whether, in fact, aggressive treatment can decrease macrovascular disease, which is the heart disease and strokes. But a very recent study, the CORD trial, seemed to indicate that there was increased mortality in the people that were tightly controlled. This study actually involved people that had been under poor control for a prolonged period of time. There were over 10,000 patients in this particular study. And what they found is that the mortality was actually increased in the group that was supposed to be under tighter control. But if we look at the totality of the data, what happened is that the overall mortality was still decreased than what would have been anticipated. And in fact, the group that attained the best control had the lowest level of mortality as compared to the group that did not attain such good hemoglobin A1C levels. So a lot of people may regard that as a reason for people not to pursue tight control, which is exactly the opposite. This should be an indication that tight control and early on aggressive management of diabetes can actually prevent complications, not just microvascular, but macrovascular as well.
A really good example from a paper released around the same time, the UK PDS 80, found that in 20-year follow-up of patients, 5,000 or so, with new-onset diabetes in the United Kingdom, were followed. They were for 10 years. One had about 1% lower A1C than the other, 7 versus 7.9%. And then 10 years later, after the end of the study, they were all followed again to see what happened. Now, they all came to the same level of A1C. The ones that were worse got a little better. The ones that were better got a little worse. But 10 years later, 20 years after the start of that study, all of the complications, eye, kidney, nerve, heart, death, all dramatically decreased with early onset of good control.
Dr. Lavernia, I know you like to talk about the deal with your patients. Tell us about the deal.
Yeah, the deal is basically putting it all out. I'm one of these fellows that writes on the paper that covers the examining table. So I like to do that image, and I like to put in the middle of it the patient and then the spokes that come off that we're going to need an ophthalmologist to help us. Sometimes we're going to need podiatry to help us. Dental care is important in these people. So there's all of these players, but in the center, it's them. And the deal is, are you going to help yourself and me out by doing some of the things that we expect from you? And that might be self-monitoring their blood glucoses, bringing in their logbook, so we can see where their disease state is going. We have to do lab values periodically. And the follow-ups are very important to see how it changes. Some are very agreeable, some aren't so, and we have to convince them that this is important to their future, to their future health care.
So what exactly is good control?
Well, there has been some debate. Different organizations have different standards. But what we're trying to do is to get people with diabetes to be as close to normal as possible. The American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists recommends a hemoglobin A1C level of 6.5 or lower. The ADA recommends a hemoglobin A1C level of 7. There is a certain discrepancy between the organizations, but the fact is that, unfortunately, the majority of our patients are far away from reaching either goal. More than 50% of our patients are not nearly where they are supposed to be. So we aim for tight control, and of course, we try our best to bring it down as close to normal as possible, because this is based on epidemiologic data showing that the closer the hemoglobin A1C is to normal, to the range of people who don't have diabetes, the lower the incidence of complications.
And yet it's not happening. By the time people wind up on insulin therapy, studies from the Pacific Northwest suggest they've been over 8% A1C, not anywhere near either the ADA or the ACE goal, for more than 5 years.